Accession number 27185, reel 17.
Major Barras, reel 17.
You were saying that one of the lessons from Dieppe was that it was important to be well prepared for.
Well, yes, I got the, people were so horrified, I think, by what happened. They began to realize that you needed much more preparation than this had been given, and more thought, and more working with the Navy and the RAF to get the plan worked out in detail beforehand, and everybody knowing what they were doing, and combined together. As I was just about to mention, Gallipoli was a fine example of how they got there and couldn't work together, the Navy and the Army. So fortunately, although not fortunately, I suppose the chaps and the Canadians who either got prisoners or were taken or died, were killed or wounded, didn't do so in vain, because perhaps without this we may not have given the same attention to what we needed to do to have a successful landing in Overlord. And the other thing, of course, it probably put the Germans on the alert. Having done it once, they could expect that we might be thinking, well, that wasn't very good, we'll try again, try and do it better somewhere else. So that meant that they had to retain troops in the West, which may have been some benefit to the Russians, who kept on complaining about not having a second front. Let me see. Yes, there's another thing which I'm sure it helped Alan Brooke with the Americans, with their gung-ho attitude of wanting to go and have a second front almost immediately. I think they just wanted to go and do it and get it over with and go home.
Had you seen anything of the Americans at that time?
No, I soon was to, though. We'll come to that very shortly, actually. But at this stage, I hadn't seen anything of them. They're not down in Botany Camp.
Did you have any expectations of them, any idea of what they might be like and what they might be able to do?
None at all. None at all. They had a very small army, of course, and a very untried one in the States at that time. They had little experience in the First World War under General Pershing, but I'm never quite sure what, in fact, they took part in the First World War. I know one of their main things was the fact that the Germans recognized there were going to be millions more of them. But we obviously know. I'd be interested
in
that.
They were involved in some substantial battles on the Western Front in 1918.
Yeah.
Around Chateau Thierry.
Right.
And also in the east around the Meuse-Argonne area.
Yeah.
So they conducted some major offensives.
Right, so they did have an effect on the ground.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Yes.
Not so much in 1917, when there weren't really enough of them.
Right.
By 1918, when they were in large numbers and they had been trained up.
Yes.
But it was a brief experience.
Yes, but you don't hear very much about it, do you? I mean, we heard all about what they did in the Second World War.
Yes.
That's too much, but what they did in the First World War, we know they arrived there, and we know the Germans took fright because they knew there were millions more coming. But what they actually did on the ground hasn't been well recorded, I don't think. Anyway, thanks for that. That's the next letter I have is dated the 28th of September. When I just say we've had a week-long exercise, where I said it was very cold and we slept under the stars, as I put it. And that's really all that came out of that letter, but it just goes to show that the exercising is still going on.
And they're quite substantial.
And quite substantial. That's a week one, yeah.
Time.
That's right. Yeah.
Do you remember taking any part in any exercises which emphasised motorised mobility?
Well, yes, quite a bit of them did by then, because by then we got troop carriers in the RASC, which we hadn't had before, where you sat along side, along the side of the vehicle. The seats were there with canvas sort of curtains down either side, which could be rolled up. And what happened was that your steps were put down at the back on both sides, and you could embark, or embus, as we call it, on two sides. And it was, we were supposed to embus as 1 second per man was the expression used, and coming off the same. I'm not quite sure. I think they could hold a platoon each. So they were tailor-made for trooping rather than sitting on the floor on the three tonners we used to have to do before. So we did use those, yes, quite a bit, especially in the advanced contact exercises, which we did quite a bit of. Of course, the thing that's occurred to me is that there was a very large garrison in the UK still. And presumably they were kept on because they'd never sure whether the Germans weren't going to beat the Russians and come back, which some of us thought they were going to before Stalingrad or before they got into trouble. It was a possibility. And then when, I suppose, the feeling came that the Russians were finally on top and there was no chance that the Germans were going to come back, they thought, well, we'll keep them here anyway for D-Day. So there was always a large garrison there, so there were large exercises. And as time went by, most of them were offensive exercises.
Do you remember when that shift came to the primarily offensive style of operation?
Oh, I think after the... Well, I think it started when we got back from Dunkirk, to be quite, you know, really, in a small way, and it gradually crept in, and obviously from the top there came the order and the outline syllabus of what the UK Army was supposed to be doing and what the training would be doing, down through the divisions, and gradually it got more and more offensive as time went by. I'm sure of that. Then we used to go on these long exercises, and they were all tooling around the countryside in vehicles. And then once you were off, of course, you were on your flat feet and you never saw them again. I mean, we were up and down the hills and marching on the roads and things.
Now, another thing that the army tended to do at certain times was put a great deal of emphasis on operating at night. Was that an important part of the...
Yes, we did have night exercises. One in particular I remember when I was the battalion IO, we did one. And of course I had to go out in front with a compass, which was the most unnerving thing that ever happened to me in my life, I think. I was going across this scrubby land with a compass, keeping the battalion on the bearing, and behind me were about 600 or 700 soldiers coming along, breathing heavily, and every time I stopped, they all stopped. Luckily, I managed to get to the right place, but I was never quite sure until I got there. Now, that was the most unnerving experience I've ever had, I think, battle included. Yes, we did do exercises at night, yeah.
Do you remember the first occasion when you got any hint of doing training for amphibious assault?
Not until we joined 56th Brigade in spring of 44, before D-Day. No, there was no... No, there was no amphibious training at all at that stage. I suppose it wouldn't have been necessary, really. You train for what? To keep yourself fit and well and able to carry out the normal functions on the battlefield. But when it comes to something which is out of the ordinary, like amphibious operations, if you did it, took part in it, and then nothing happened for a year, there wasn't really much point in doing it, I suppose. So they waited until they knew that we were going to take part, and then it started. It came in March and April of 44.
So you're carrying on as a company commander within the battalion.
Yeah.
And that went on for some months, didn't it?
Well, yes, it did. In the 6th of October, a letter I've got here, we moved into what I would call winter quarters. We changed again. This is one of, I suppose, the main things which these letters... Without these letters, I would never have known all this. Mm. So it's the addresses at the head of the letters which I sent my father and mother. We moved into... The postal address was the Grange, Alsford, Hants. But that's where Battan headquarters was. Mm. As a company, we were in Byton, a little village near Alsford. Because on these occasions, the battalion was always split up with companies nearing villages all around, according to the accommodation availability. And we were in Byton House, in Byton Village, and we shared it with B Company, I remember, Desmond Brown, who was the company commander at that time. And we lived in the house. We had our company stores in the house. The company offices were in the house. We had our little mess there. And we slept in there, and the warrant officers, the secret messes, and senior sergeants, I think, slept in there also. And everybody else were in Nissen huts in the grounds, with NCOs in charge of each Nissen hut. The dining hall would have been in a Nissen hut, I suppose. But I'm just trying to think how we cooked our own meals. I mean, we didn't live on ceremony at all. Like you would in a battalion, where you would all lunch and dinner and so forth, big proper times, given times. Our batman used to cook us up something, I think, and then when we were ready for it, we ate it. We get the rations; they get the rations which everybody else got. And if we go augmented, I don't know whether we bought something from outside, augmented or not. I don't know.
Well, Hampshire is a rich agricultural county.
Oh yes, yes. Well, he probably bought some carrots or something. I don't know. Eggs, that was the main thing. Yeah. Eggs were very popular then. Very hard to get, too. We had that awful egg powder stuff sometimes. So there we were. Byton was 2 miles from town headquarters. So under those conditions, I think we did a lot of training, company training on our own out there. I know in my letter I wrote that I was an enthusiastic letter about being in a house which had actually got furniture and a fireplace. Now, yes, I've got a note here to say that one of the things I did there, we all did, was to go and do some exercises with the Home Guard. At the weekends, what happened was that we used to go out and attack a village with the Home Guard in it, and then we'll finish up in the pub afterwards. But I do remember I felt a bit guilty afterwards, because I did an attack once on one village, and I arrived in the outskirts of the village and they knew we were there. I then left a couple of carriers there and went round the back, round the side, round to the other side of the village. And in a given signal, I told a couple of carriers to put smoke down over the other side. And, of course, they all thought the attack was coming in there and put all their available reserves and everything over there. And we just walked in the other side and then captured their pub, it's the first place we made for, actually.
Was the village pub,
yes.
Tactical objective number one.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Which angered them a bit. But, no, they were very good about it. But I felt I'd done a dirty trick on them a bit. But it did teach them a lesson.
Isn't this a legitimate ruse de guerre?
Yes.
To make a distraction on one side of the objective. Yeah.
It was quite simple and normal, quite a simple thing to do.
How many carriers did you have normally?
I have my one company carrier.
Yes.
But on these occasions, I'd have a section of carriers, probably.
From the platoon?
Carrier platoon.
And they'd be attached to it?
And they'd be attached to me as company commander.
Yes, but normally they'd be part of... Would they be part of headquarter company or...
S company.
Support company.
Yes. Yeah. The carrier platoon. By then, we'd organised all the fighting bits had been taken out of headquarter company.
Yes. An S company.
Because, you remember, there was only headquarter company and infantry companies. Mm. Well, then they founded S company, a support company, and put all the firing bits in there, mortars, anti-tank guns and so forth.
But I mean, wouldn't S Company on operations, wouldn't its elements normally be distributed out down to the rifle companies?
Quite often. It depends on the operation.
Yes.
But always there would be a section at least would form part of an advance guard.
Mm.
An advance guard was a company which normally had a section of mortars, section of carriers, an FOO, maybe a sort pioneer section or something if they thought they were going to come up against mines which needed lifting or
yes.
something like that. But it was usually self-contained because it would operate well ahead of the main body.
What sort of strength could the Home Guard generate for these exercises at village level?
Well, it depended on the size of the village, I suppose, but there's usually 100 or so of them. Yeah.
That's a good company strength.
Yes, that, yes. Perhaps it wasn't as much as that.
Hmm.
I really can't remember. I remember going when I went round the Isle of Wight lecturing to them. There were usually quite a large number there. I think every able-bodied person, certainly in the villages, I'm not sure about the towns, all joined up. Anybody able-bodied, young boys who were too young to be called up, older men who were too old to be called up, and people in occupations which they couldn't leave, weren't allowed to leave. So, I mean, I think they mostly all joined up, and I think anybody who didn't join up felt he was a bit out of it, or everybody thought, you know, look at him in the pub and say, why aren't you with us, George, or whatever. It was a thing to do. So, that used to happen. And then, oh yes, the other thing which I got at this stage, the CO told me to run a course for NCOs of the battalion.
Would this be a cadre course?
Well, I suppose.
Well, was it established NCOs or potential NCOs?
No, established NCOs.
Yes.
It was a 4-week operation, and I had NCOs from each company.
Mm.
But of course, there wasn't any syllabus. There wasn't anything which I could hang my hat on, which had happened before. So really I had to sit down and write the syllabus. I'm sure I did it with the second in command as well, because he would be responsible for training and find out exactly what it was they wanted the NCOs trained in. It was mostly all tactical stuff. It wouldn't have been weapon training or anything like that, because they got there to it anyway. But I suppose the CO came to the conclusion, well, he's been on this, doing this 5-course school stuff for all this time, we can make use of his knowledge.
What did you train them in then? Was it platoon tactics?
It was tactics and organisation, yes. On the same basis as we did it in the school, but on perhaps a slightly lower level.
Do you know why the CO wanted this done, what his thinking was behind it?
Well, it's like any other bit of training, I suppose. By then he thought that they could do with it. Perhaps on exercises they may have shown that they, some of them... weren't up to doing what they should have done, in giving out orders, wrecking the ground. See, reconnaissance all comes into this. Camouflage. All that sort of thing of spotting where the enemy were. And my favourite was what I called the thump crack. In other words, when a rifle goes off and is firing at you, it goes thump. And then the crack is when the bullet is flying overhead. So you don't worry about the crack. If you want to find out where the enemy are, you listen and try and trace where the thump came from. So that's the sort of thing which, you try and teach them and get them into more detailed thinking. So it was all really, I suppose the CO also thought, well, this guy's come back from 5-course school, we can perhaps get some of our NCOs done the same way.
How many of them did you manage to get done? Did you manage to work through battalion's worth?
No. I think they were selected corporals and then lance corporals. They weren't sergeants.
Oh.
They were corporals and lance corporals.
So it's bringing on the junior NCOs.
That's right, yes. So hopefully... one would try and sort of make them into potential platoon sergeants, because you had to remember in battle you have to have somebody who can take over.
Yeah. So it's really getting together reserve platoon commanders in a way.
In a way, yes. But making them more competent section commanders, so that they got their tactics right in giving out, because they don't get an awful lot of practice at giving out orders when somebody's there to hear them and know whether they've given them out correctly. So, I mean, that's one of the things which I know I did, was to get them to give out in the same way as I got them in five course school, and the same way as I had to do in the company commander's courses, giving out orders for an operation, which probably is the most important thing a leader has to do, because if he doesn't give out
the right orders
which are intelligible to everybody, then the thing, it isn't done. Which reminds me of I don't know if I can tell you a story on the gunners. So there's a when the Americans were there, there was a friend of mine in the gunners who went up in an FOO, observation post, where the Americans were firing. And there was an American gunner there who was doing the FOO, and his general was standing behind him. And the FOO gave out his orders. And, of course, not unlike our guys who come up on the radio and say, shot one over or something, you get the voice at the other end saying, they're on the way. See, and the shells came over the top and shattered on the other hillside, with it, way off target. Mm. General said, Lieutenant Jones docked $10, next shoot. You see, as if he was in court with them. Find him on the spot.
What, the FOO or the gun position officer?
No, the FOO.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, for giving up. He came to the conclusion he'd given the wrong order, hadn't identified the target correctly, or had not got his estimations right on distance, and just docked him $10 on the spot.
How did you teach your course, your NCOs? Was it by classroom instruction, or did you take them out on the ground?
Both. We started off inside. I think we had to start with giving them the organisation again, and then giving them some ideas to what the battalion consisted of and what support they could expect. And then going on, I went on further than that, went back to tanks and artillery and so forth. Not too far, because I don't think they wanted to get involved in strategy at that time. And then we go outside and we did toots with them. We built up to that towards the end. It was a question of identifying targets on the ground to start with, judging distances and all that sort of thing, map reading. We brought them into, which perhaps a lot of them hadn't done, identifying objects on the ground from the map, looking at things like dead ground, reverse slopes, all this sort of thing. Once you get out in the open, there's all kinds of things to talk about.
How did they respond?
Oh, they were, as far as I remember, they were very enthusiastic. Yeah. I don't remember any sort of... I mean, as long as you kept them interested and they felt they were learning something which they didn't already know.
They were happy.
Yes. If you try and tell somebody, go through, spend an hour telling somebody something they already know and think they know better than you do anyway, you lost them. So we try to keep it as... I won't say they were totally interested for the whole time they were there. They must have been bored at times, I expect. But we did our best. I got some sergeants to help me, giving instructions and help with the supervision and that sort of thing. So that was that one. I just got a note here to say on recreation, we used to go into Winchester, blessed memory, which wasn't an awful lot to do.
I was going to ask what Winchester had to offer.
Not an awful lot. We used to organise dances, I remember, for the soldiers locally in Alsford. Get some of the local girls in. Don't know how we managed to get them in, but there was always somebody in the village or town who was willing to come and help us organise these things in a village hall. Sometimes there were ATS or nurses or other people locally who came in as well. Then, of course, there was the old Hussy Hussy, which was always was a favourite, which used to go on in an effie, when there was an effie. We didn't always have an effie. I suppose there must have been one in Winchester.
Presumably there'd have been pubs in Alsford and in the villages.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
There were far more pubs in the countryside those days, weren't there?
Oh, that's right, yes. Oh, there were pubs that chaps could go to, as long as they were back in time for lights out or whatever it was in those days. But the recreational transport was available once every... According to my letter, one of my letters I wrote, was once every fortnight you could have free transport into Winchester. Where we all took advantage of it. But other than that, it was merely a question of local initiative, really.
What happened at weekends? Did you carry on normal routine training at weekends? Or
I think we took Sunday off.
Yes.
We took Sunday off. We worked on Saturdays. In fact, we were working on Saturdays right up to well after the war. And then we worked Saturday mornings, and usually had sport on the Saturday afternoon. What we used to do was to have a... That's right, we had one afternoon during the week, usually Wednesday for sport, and then Saturday afternoon for sport. And if we could get hold of a local football field or something like that, then we used it and played another company, or the battalion would play another battalion, or even a local team quite often. And then there were cross-country runs, of course, we always fell back on those when there were no other facilities.
Well, an important part of fitness training.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Cross-country run.
Yes. They were quite frequent. Mm. So I got a note here to say in November we came to, we'd last be getting good news. We got Alamein, and then followed by Operation Torch, which came soon after. And then I remember Alamein, I remember the very words that the enemy were in full retreat. I remember those words. And then all the church bells rang, which was a magnificent thing. That's the first time we really got outstanding news of that sort, you know, since East Africa and the desert in 1940, really, when we mopped the Italians up. And then, of course, the Russians had surrounded Stalingrad about that time, although the surrender didn't take place until February, I don't think, next year. So all the news at that time was coming through was very good and gladdened our hearts. I think it was pretty certain that the Germans by that time were never going to invade us. It looked as if
if they hadn't done it in 41 and 42.
No. Yeah, that's right.
Given the naval balance of power.
Yes.
It must have seemed rather implausible they would attempt it.
Yes, yes. I always thought they were going to have difficulty anyway. Mm. The lack of knowledge. Look at Dieppe. Look at what happened in Dieppe. I mean, I know that they had a lot of troops there on the spot, but...
Well, they had far less experience historically.
They had no historical experience of combined operations at all. They looked, I think it was Goering said, looked upon as going across a river. But of course, it wasn't. Or wouldn't have been. Anyway, that's going back a bit. So all that good news was coming through. And then I got a letter dated the 23rd of November, when I've got here nothing but exercises. So we're still at it right into November, although we've gone into winter quarters. And I got a note here about 25-mile marches and force marches, which I've mentioned before, so we're getting into that. Then my next letter was dated the 26th of December. Perhaps I could just read you a little bit of that, because it's